Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Peter Kornbluth, senior analyst with the National Security Archive, who takes a critical look at President Bush's appointment of Henry Kissinger to lead a commission charged with investigating the September 11th terrorist attacks. Assad Abu Khalil, author of the forthcoming book The House of Bush and the House of Saud, who advocates a change in U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia that challenges the oil-rich kingdom's repressive policies and religious intolerance. And Bangladeshi doctor, author, and feminist Taslima Nazreen, who, speaking from life experience, discusses her view that religion promotes violence, ignorance, and injustice. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The news magazine In These Times reports that struggling Russian farmers are upset with the plan to legalize the sale of farmland for the first time since the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution. Many fear that the law, set to take effect in January 2003, will encourage outside land speculators to come in and force out existing farm families. Recent Russian public opinion polls show that a majority of all citizens oppose private ownership of land, with the most intense opposition coming from the collective farmers. To further complicate the issue of land privatization, more than 30 million Russians own shares in collective farms, and over the last decade, most individual farmers have leased land from Soviet-era farm collectives. Alexander Poprov, a successful farmer who leases his land, says he cannot afford to buy the land. "I have no money," he says. "I put all my profits back into the operation. Everything that I have built will be lost if I don't have access to the land." Poprov lamented, "Some oligarch will come in here, buy the land, and offer to make me his serf. I'll say no thanks, and I'll be back on the street with nothing again." Two politically connected Texas energy companies are using their clout in the Bush White House to get $900 million in public financing for an ecologically destructive natural gas project that will cut through Peru's rainforest. In the coming weeks, the project's backers, Hunt Oil Company and Vice President Dick Cheney's old firm Halliburton, are looking for funding from the Export-Import Bank of the United States and Inter-American Development Bank. The lending institutions have a review process that states the project it funds must not threaten natural habitats. Already, Peru's energy ministry has fined the pipeline's backers $1 million for clearing too much rainforest land. According to the Washington Post, environmental groups such as the World Wildlife Fund, Friends of the Earth, and Amazon Watch oppose the project, which would cut through the homeland of the Chimas, a native tribe of 600 people. The World Wildlife Fund has put the area on its list of 200 endangered places and fears construction of the new pipeline will lead to loss of habitat, loss of food for the Chimas, and contamination of the headwaters. The Hunt Group won the right to exploit the Peruvian rainforest 2 years ago after earlier efforts by Royal Dutch Shell collapsed due to antitrust concerns. Prospects for funding from the Inter-American Development Bank look good, taking into consideration those who are influencing the decision. Jose Forquant of the U.S. Treasury Department is Washington's representative for the bank and raised over $100,000 for the Bush campaign in 2000. Ray Hunt is a longtime political backer of the Bush family who personally gave $20,000 to the Republican Victory Committee and sits on the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Mother Jones Magazine reports that little of the $246 billion tobacco settlement is being spent fighting the smoking habit. Instead, many states have used the new funds to pay for existing government operations, fund pork barrel projects, or to make up for growing state budget gaps. Some states, like North Carolina and Virginia, are actually using the settlement monies to benefit tobacco producers. In North Carolina, funds have paid for new tobacco curing equipment and to produce a video for the state-backed tobacco museum. Amazingly, seven states have used the funds to invest in tobacco company stock. According to data from the National Conference of State Legislatures, only 5% of the $33 billion already paid out to states in the tobacco settlement have gone to anti-smoking campaigns. In the last year alone, states have slashed anti-smoking programs 13% due to mounting budget deficits. Mike Moore, the Mississippi Attorney General who settled one of the first cases with tobacco companies, said, "This is moral treason. If you don't use the proceeds to impact public health, what did we fight this for?" Without new anti-smoking programs, states will eventually pay the costs of treating hundreds of thousands of adults and children who will suffer from smoking-related diseases like lung cancer. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Britta Brundage. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
The appointment by President Bush of Henry Kissinger to lead an investigation into the September 11th terrorist attacks has provoked criticism by many in the U.S. and around the world. Those who have followed Mr. Kissinger's career as National Security Advisor to President Nixon and later serving as Gerald Ford's Secretary of State are skeptical that this tainted Washington insider is capable of conducting an objective inquiry. Mr. Kissinger's involvement in the overthrow of democratic governments such as Chile, the Indonesian invasion of East Timor, his role in the secret bombing of Cambodia, as well as his well-documented record of misleading Congress and the American people, have contributed to efforts across the globe to prosecute the Nobel Prize-winning diplomat for his complicity in crimes against humanity. The threat of an indictment is so real that Mr. Kissinger now consults a lawyer before leaving the U.S. Other questions about possible conflicts of interest stemming from his list of powerful corporate clients working with his business consulting firm Kissinger & Associates have surfaced. Mr. Kissinger maintains that his client list is secret and he alone will be the judge of any potential ethical conflicts. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive, who has closely studied Mr. Kissinger's career and explains why he believes the former diplomat is not the right person to lead the 9/11 commission.
He gets credit for a number of bold initiatives. He was the original shuttle diplomat in trying to bring peace to the Middle East. He set the stage for Nixon's dramatic opening to communist China. But on the other side, most of his policies, covert operations in Chile, secret bombings of Cambodia, domestic spying on his own aides, including wiretapping his chief deputies without their knowledge, are part of what makes his name synonymous with secrecy in government, with closed government. He was also known to be the consummate insider, you know, playing up to the presidents that he served, telling them what they wanted to hear, really playing, first fiddle to the powers that be. And that's the kind of first major strike against him. Second issue involved with Kissinger is he really hasn't been honest about many of these policies. I believe my research shows that he misled the Congress of the United States and the American people about operations in Chile and what they were intended for. We caught him in a rather bald misrepresentation of his involvement in the invasion of East Timor by Indonesia in 1975. His memoirs are riddled with deception about this history, and that brings up the issue of his honesty and his integrity from the past. And the third issue about him is a broader one. It's his policies that he was the architect of, policies to undermine the democratically elected government of Chile and to embrace the military regime of Augusto Pinochet, the secret bombing of Cambodia, covert operations in Angola, allying the United States with the apartheid regime of South Africa, et cetera, that have earned the United States the hostility of a good part of the world. He was the architect of many of the most controversial policies that went on in the mid-1970s, which still resonate negatively around the world today. All of these things are issues, I think, in his leadership of this commission.
Peter Kornbluh, how do you respond to those supporters of the Kissinger appointment to lead this investigation that Mr. Kissinger, through all his years in government, knows quite well bureaucracy? He also knows about government secrecy, and he can crack the critical problems that face the various agencies of the United States in confronting and preventing terrorism.
Well, there's no doubt that Henry Kissinger is an extremely brilliant man, of an intellectual giant who can conceptualize these problems and certainly try and address them. The issue is whether he will be aggressive when it comes to bringing accountability to the feet of those in power, you know, right up to President George Bush himself, who was briefed in August by the CIA about Osama bin Laden's possible attacks forthcoming in the United States, and appears not to have done anything in response. And that is the critical issue, is whether Kissinger, having distorted the concept of U.S. national security when he was in office to justify his policies in Chile and Cambodia and Angola and Bangladesh and elsewhere, now can follow through on the issues that are truly necessary for our national security and personal safety in this country. Yeah, I don't think you needed a consummate insider to have chaired this commission. I think you needed somebody who had a clean slate, who the country saw as credible, who was aggrieved by what had happened. And there are many candidates, I think, other than Kissinger, whose controversial past is simply going to overshadow the next 18 months of work on this issue.
You think Mr. Kissinger will be engaged in damage control on behalf of the Bush administration in a blatant way, or do you think he'll be more nuanced in how he handles this thing?
We need this investigation. We need it to be as strong and thorough as possible. It's the most important independent inquiry to take place in our country since the attack on Pearl Harbor more than 50 years ago. But I think that, having said that, everybody has to remember that the Bush administration did not want this commission to be created. They wanted a congressional investigation that was tempered by the Republican allies that the Bush administration had in Congress. You have to ask yourself, I mean, that's a giveaway right there. How can we have an executive branch that doesn't want an independent inquiry into the worst attack on the United States of America ever? How could we have a president that wasn't from the first moment dedicated to doing absolutely everything possible to figuring out who dropped the ball, how and why, and how to make sure it didn't happen again? And yet this administration opposed this commission until the moral pressure translated through political voices of the victims' families won out, and the administration finally agreed to do this. So given the Bush's kind of reticence and reluctance already, I think you have to ask why he picked the person that he did, what he expects to really happen with Kissinger. And I think we're going to have to all use the Freedom of Information Act and keep our ears to the ground to make sure that every stone is being unturned here, and that this commission points the finger of accountability at every agency and every policymaker that didn't do everything that could have been done to have detected and deterred the plans for the attack on September 11th.
That was Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive. His forthcoming book, The Pinochet File, will soon be published by the New Press. Since the September 11th terrorist attacks, where 15 of the 19 men who hijacked three U.S. planes were citizens of Saudi Arabia, the oil-rich kingdom has come under close scrutiny. The fact that the Al-Qaeda terror network mastermind Osama bin Laden is a member of one of Saudi Arabia's most prominent families has also contributed to new inquiries into Saudi terror connections. But because of the strategic importance of Saudi Arabia, possessing the single largest reserves of oil in the world, successive American presidents have been hesitant to criticize the Saudi monarchy, their government's repressive policies, and officially sanctioned religious intolerance. In the post-9/11 period, the Bush family's positive personal and business relationship with members of the royal Saudi family has added additional conflicts of interest in formulating U.S. policies to effectively confront the roots of terrorism. Recent unconfirmed reports alleging that the U.S.-Saudi ambassador's wife had funneled money to 9/11 hijackers underscores the strains now apparent in this once strong relationship. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Asad Abu Khalil, associate political science professor at California State University and author of the forthcoming book, The House of Bush and the House of Saud. Professor Abu Khalil explains why he feels the U.S. must dramatically transform its relationship with the Saudis if our nation is serious about applying one standard in challenging oppression and supporting human rights.
There has always been a very close association between the government of the United States, the elite of the United States, and the elite of Saudi Arabia. There's a certain kinship between the royal family and the so-called royal families of the United States who have ruled over. And one of the things I point out is that there are so many paradoxes about this relationship. They tell us that they are based on shared values, and one wonders what these are, unless they are speaking about religious intolerance, unless they are speaking about misogyny and extremism and sexism that prevails in much of Saudi Arabia. The President of the United States, despite the negative press of Saudi Arabia in this country, assured the Crown Prince in a phone interview that there is a permanent, eternal friendship between the two. While there is now sudden attention to the record of the royal family in funding and financing and supporting some elements of fundamentalist extremist Islam, the United States has a similar joint effort in that regard. For much of the recent history of the Cold War, the United States, through the CIA and the Defense Department, worked hand in hand with the royal family to support, sponsor, and arm extremist fundamentalist Islam, all in the hope of undermining the powers of secularism and socialism in the Middle East. In many ways, you cannot open the files of the responsibility of Saudi Arabia in the support for the Islamic extremism from which emerged bin Laden without paying some attention to the same record by the U.S. government.
Why has the Bush administration gone out of its way to placate the Saudi royal family? There are many obvious answers to that question, including the word petroleum.
Well, I mean, it's not only about oil, however. Oil is a big factor, but not only this government, Bush, as well as Clinton, as well as Bush before him, as well as Reagan, Carter, everybody, they have had extremely deferential, respectful relationship with the royal family because they are basically obedient clients of the United States. They do what they are told, and most importantly, they provide the United States with cheap oil, and they play an extremely pro-American role within the OPEC organization of petroleum exporting countries. And for that, they are rewarded with the kind of praise and deferential treatment that they receive.
What should American citizens be concerned about in terms of the relationship between the Bush family and
right.
the House of Saud?
Well, very good question. In fact, in my forthcoming book on the subject, I warn about the consequences of U.S. foreign policy towards Saudi Arabia. And I say that in many cases, September 11 is an outgrowth of this policy of the United States toward that government. The United States has now more than 10,000 troops in that kingdom to prop up an extremely corrupt, unpopular, despised regime in the region. And we suffer in America today because of that policy. And the Bush family, the father certainly, and the son, through oil interests, have had those close ties to the royal family. The father and many of the people within his administration have been involved with the Carlyle Group, which has extremely strong ties to the royal family of Saudi Arabia. The response by America to Saudi Arabia after September 11 is largely technical. We wanted to crack down against financing. We wanted to arrest more people. But not a single word is said about the most troubling aspect of the relationship, which is Saudi Arabia is running one of the most oppressive countries of the world. And not a word you hear in the press or in the government about sexism in Saudi Arabia, discrimination in the country, and the lack of freedoms.
Now, Saudi Arabia has played it down the middle of the road in terms of its position on any future U.S. war undertaken against Iraq and the government of Saddam Hussein.
Right.
Obviously, there are a lot of considerations for the Saudi royal family, balancing the maintenance of a long-term relationship with Washington and the fear that they have of angering a population that could overthrow their monarchy.
The royal family is concerned. You see, the United States after September 11 is running according to the principle of what I call the Hamid Karzai rule, according to which the United States will only tolerate clients who are supportive of U.S. foreign policy 100%. 90%, 95%, 99% kind of clientage is not going to be tolerated by the United States. This really explains the trouble that now is faced in the relationship between the two countries. Saudi Arabia wants to be loyal to the United States, but they are also worried about their own domestic audiences. You see, there is a kind of bind that the royal family finds itself in. On the one hand, you want to please the United States, but on the other hand, the more you please the United States, the more you displease your people. So which way do you want to go? And the Saudi family is under pressure by the Americans to go along with America much more closely, to align themselves with America more. But they are becoming increasingly unpopular in the kingdom, because there is a mounting tide of anti-Americanism in the kingdom itself. It's very fair to say that had the United States government over the years not embraced and endorsed the Saudi corrupt royal family, the fight between bin Laden and the House of Saud would be a fight that would have taken place on Saudi soil. In other words, we would have been spared September 11th.
That was Asad Abu Khalil, associate political science professor at California State University and author of the forthcoming book, The House of Bush and the House of Saud, soon to be published by Seven Stories Press. More than 200 Nigerians were killed in riots in late November when Muslims protested against a beauty pageant scheduled to be held in their country as offensive to Islam. What set off the furor was a newspaper column that had suggested that if Muhammad were still alive, he might take one of the beauty contestants for his wife. The resulting violence forced the pageant to be moved to London amid calls for the beheading of the female columnist. Taslima Nazreen can relate to the Nigerian journalist dilemma. Nazreen, a Bangladeshi medical doctor and writer, was forced into exile under a death threat for criticizing Islam for its treatment of women in her own nation. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Taslima Nazreen during a recent book tour promoting the English translation of the first volume of her memoirs titled Maya Bella, My Bengali Girlhood. In it, Nazreen describes growing up in a middle-class Muslim household in Bangladesh, where she was repeatedly raped by male relatives beginning at age 6. She describes her father's philandering and her mother's desperate clinging to religion to give her miserable life meaning. Nazreen, an atheist and humanist, presents her views on the backwardness of religion and on what women who live in Bangladesh and other religiously dominated societies need to improve the quality of their lives.
In Bangladesh, we don't need any religious laws, and we don't need any religious schools. We need secular education for both men and women, and we need equality and justice between men and women. Actually, the religious law don't give any equality to women.
You don't really make too much distinction between religion and the fundamentalist version of religion, and particularly since you come from Islam, you've criticized Islam particularly. You made some comment about religion is the root and fundamentalism is the branch or something like that. And if you cut fundamentalism and you don't get rid of the root being religion, it'll grow back.
Yeah, I don't find any difference between religion and religious fundamentalism. Religious fundamentalists practice religion correctly. The Islamic fundamentalists follow the real Islam. There are many Muslims you would find that who believe in equality and justice. They, even though they say that they are Muslim, but they are not real Muslim, because if they follow the Quran, if they follow the words of Allah, they would have to do the injustice to women.
Now, if George Bush said what you just said about there's no difference between, you know, Islamic fundamentalists and Islam, he would have been roundly criticized by people who felt like he was, especially after 9/11, that he was promoting, you know, retaliation against all Muslims in the U.S. or around the world. But you're saying it out of your own experience.
The Quran says, kill the disbelievers. Don't make any friendship with Christian or Jewish. In 9/11, the terrorists, they killed the people who were disbelievers. And they follow the Quran. They accept the Quranic advice. Because of religion, there is bloodshed everywhere. Because of religion, there is hatred among people. Because of religion, there is illiteracy, poverty. Because of religion, there millions of women have been suffering. They are flogged, stoned, and burned to death. Because of religion, there are injustices and inequalities. It's not only Islam. All the religions are created by men for their own interest, for their own comfort, for their own fun. So women don't have any place in religion. They are treated as slaves and sexual objects. because religious laws oppress women so that in the Western country you needed to separate the state and churches, in Islamic countries we need the same thing. We need to separate state and religion. But I still criticize American foreign policy, because bombing in the Muslim country would not solve the problem. Bombing in Afghanistan actually created more fundamentalists in Muslim countries.
How did you get the courage to do what you've done and to live the life the way that you do?
Actually, I don't think it's very courageous things I did, because it is normal. It's normal to protest against the inequalities and injustices, and I did. I wanted women to be treated like human beings, but women are oppressed by religion, by traditions, by culture, and by customs, and I wanted to change the system. I wanted to encourage other women to fight against the evil forces. But other women shut their mouth because it is difficult for them to protest against the system, male-made system, against the male-made religious laws. I didn't care what people would say to me, whether people would kill me, whether people would hang me in public. I didn't care. I just felt that somebody should cry out loud, somebody should protest. I did. I don't think that it is courageous. I think that everybody should have done this. Everybody should do this, should protest. But why they don't do, this is my question.
That was Taslima Nazreen, medical doctor, author, and feminist. The first volume of her autobiography, Mayabella, My Bengali Girlhood, is available from Steerforth Press. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.